super. Okay, after the rediscovery of Aristotle and the growth of universities starting about the 12th century, the subject was more about commentaries on his works, particularly on the heavens, De Caelo in Latin, or his physics, other such works. And there were teachings also from Muslim and Jewish philosophers and thinkers if they had been translated into Latin. What there wasn't much of was any experience derived from empirical knowledge. Science, however, arose much more slowly and a great deal later, and it's generally attributed to the 17th and then the 18th centuries, the so-called Age of Enlightenment. The word science is not Greek, but rather Latin, and it comes from the word for knowledge, or scientia. And it is primarily used not as a body of knowledge, but rather as a technique of study, one which organizes knowledge in the form of testable explanations and predictions about the universe. And it is precisely the idea of testing that separates science from natural philosophy. It is one of the great misfortunes of modern time that our educational system, particularly in the schools, tends to treat science as a body of knowledge that the kids have got to learn, rather than as a method of inquiry and asking questions, something that many of us are still trying to change. But to describe these changes, which are so dramatic and so revolutionary and so important, in the course of five lectures rather than a one-year university course, is, I'm afraid, the height of hubris. Hubris was something that was well recognized by the Greeks, but mostly attributed to human interactions and not divine ones. It particularly is marked when the orator Demosthenes criticized the corrupt businessman Midias, and Midias responded by punching Demosthenes in the nose. However, the most famous example, of course, of hubris is the case of Icarus flying close to the sun and the wax in his wings melting and him falling and drowning in the sea. If those same Greek gods are watching, I'm in a lot of trouble, I'm afraid. Medieval and ancient peoples aimed at the contemplation of nature and of being, but we moderns want to use science to dominate nature and to make it work to make our lives more easily. And this is a deep and fundamental change. And in many cases, what this has resulted in is the loss of the world in which we used to live. We've had to replace that world and replace it with not only the fundamental concepts and its attributes, but even our very framework of thought. The scientific and philosophical revolution, and we really can't divide those two, can roughly be described as the disappearance of the cosmos we knew, the disappearance of the conception of the world as a finite, closed, and hierarchically ordered whole, and its replacement by an indefinite, even infinite universe that's bound together by the identity of its components and laws, and in which all these components are basically on the same footing. And of course, what has happened because of this is we have lost some of the values that ancient peoples had in terms of perfection, of harmony, of meaning, and even in many cases the divorce of the world of value from the world of facts. For people interested in this kind of problem, I would recommend the writings of the German Jewish philosopher Max Horkheimer, who died in recently 1973, which for me is still recent. He was the founder of the Frankfurt School of Social Research when he was allowed to live in Germany. And he speaks passionately of the elevation of reason as an instrument of truth, but the loss of the principle that civilization is largely a matter of the inculcation of moral principles. This is a subject that is considerable and which I will not touch on. But the tendency of historians throughout the ages, particularly in the 19th century, to label eras, the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, this leads
those of us who are not historians to prejudicial attitudes towards these particular areas. For example, nothing interesting or important could happen in a dark age, and in an age of enlightenment must have been an age of brilliance and light and wonder and truth. And of course, these are serious misconceptions, as we found by the discovery of incredible technologies and beautiful artworks from the so-called Dark Ages. And it is easy to trace from the Age of Enlightenment to serious dictatorial and murderous regimes in the 20th century. So one must be careful with labels. There is no proof at all that any important skills of the Greco-Roman world were lost during the Dark Ages, even in the unenlightened West, much less in the flourishing Byzantine and Persian Saracenic empires. The full technology of antiquity was available, and that's why I have put this thing. This is the tomb of the Ostrogothic king Theodoric in Ravenna, and this top is a single stone, a monolith that weighs 276 tons and was brought in the 5th century from Istria, which is now in Croatia, to Ravenna, and that's a very long distance to carry a big rock. Also, a few centuries later, Charlemagne was capable of taking gigantic columns and things over the Alps from Ravenna to his capital in Aachen. But obsolete systems of scientific thought, which appear bizarre to us looking back from the 21st century, become intelligible when we understand the questions they were designed to answer. The question makes sense of the answers. So that key aspects of philosophy and of science really become understandable only within the context of thought and opportunity of metaphysical, of theological, of scientific, of technical, and intellectual thinking of which they formed part. Science genuinely progresses by making discoveries and detecting mistakes. And that works really well for science. But we humans, weak things that we are, have tended to try to adopt and adapt this kind of thinking to areas in which it is not necessarily appropriate. And this leads, for example, to things like the so-called Whig interpretation of history, where we look at history as a series of progressive goal-oriented steps, which it certainly is not. We cannot understand any of the developments I want to talk about without considering the history of the period. And I will talk a considerable amount about the history of the period. The Greeks invented science as we know it. Earlier civilizations, Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, India, China, they had remarkable technologies, much earlier and in fact even greater than that of the Greeks. But they were not accompanied by any kind of conception of a general or systematic investigation, what we might call a scientific way of looking at these. These older civilizations could predict, for example, detailed motions of heavenly bodies, the appearance of eclipses, the motion of the stars and of the planets, things I will actually talk about on Saturday. But they didn't offer any explanations of these phenomena other than associate them with mythology and a society of gods. The Greeks, on the other hand, invented natural science because they looked for intelligible, impersonal permanence which underlay this world of change which we see. This started in a serious fashion with the thinker Thales of Miletus about 600 BCE when he asked the question, what is the universe made of? Christianity added to this the view of nature as sacramental, as symbolic of spiritual truths. And St. Augustine represents both of these ideas because he was deeply influenced by Platonic thought. In the 12th century, a time that's often called the Renaissance of the 12th century, a new element was added. People began to ask how these events that are recorded in Genesis could be explained on a rational basis. This came partly because of the recovery of Greek and Arabic science, the rediscovery of the works of Euclid and Aristotle, and the addition of empiricism to the rationality of mathematics and philosophy, and a gradual empirical system that sought to understand the rational structure of nature. Aristotle presented a complete system of scientific thought, but it became understood that this was not either adequate or even reasonable, and the history of medieval science is the history of working out of the consequences of a new approach to nature. Science did not conflict in the minds of these people in any sense, in any way, with the idea of divine providence, but it did lead to changes in the relationship between faith and reason. Contradictions within the Aristotle system and then with observed facts led us to rational criticisms and the growth of experiment and the possibility of technology and new mathematical techniques made for a positive increase in knowledge. By about 900, the Christian West seemed under serious problems. There were sieges by the Norsemen, by the Magyars, by the Muslims, and survival did not seem likely. Yet, by the end of the 15th century, Western Europe had swept the earth, and it was exploring, trading, looting, conquering, colonizing, and remained doing so for the next 400 years. There are many reasons for that period, but certainly one of them was the development of technology. Europe had built the most efficient and deadly armaments in the world. It had ships and methods of navigation that allowed not only to circumnavigate the globe, but to maintain communications amongst various very widespread places. I wish there were enough time to discuss all of medieval technology, and perhaps I have the time sometime in the future to come back to this. But in particular, there's the so-called secular trinity, the magnetic compass, gunpowder, and the printing press that liberated Europe basically from medieval bondage and things like the use of non-human power, the watermill, the windmill, the crank to turn rotary motion into reciprocal motion, animal power, etc., made this great revolution in human history possible. A quote I have here says that the later Middle Ages, it was not not its cathedral or its epics or its scholasticism that was the glory. It was the building for the first time in history of a complex civilization which rested not on the backs of sweating slaves or of coolies, but primarily on non-human power. This is also seen in the change from Romanesque to Gothic art, which is similar to the change that happened in natural philosophy, from an age indifferent to the investigation of nature to one deeply influenced and concerned in it. Again, reflecting the difference between Plato and Aristotle's works were largely unknown until the 12th century, early Christian thinkers were really unaware of what we would call reality today. The world was created by God for man for his spiritual edification and nothing else. With the discovery of Aristotle, the beginnings of Gothic art, the early stirrings of scholasticism, came an increasing focus on naturalism, which reached from art to philosophy and theology. Strangely enough, this change could not be personified any better than by that most unlikely person, St. Francis of Assisi. It was Francis preaching to plants and animals that moved us away from the human-centered, anthropocentric world. The church has chosen to forgive what is a serious heresy and minimize the deviation that Francis made from the anthropocentric world, which was a church dogma before that. But it may be said, actually, without exaggeration, that Francis first taught Europe that nature is interesting and important in and of itself. It's no accident that the people of his order, the Franciscans, were the leading exponents of the new natural sciences in the 13th century. This activity is found throughout their order, but centered primarily in the Franciscan school at Oxford. And this became the most vital intellectual center of 13th and early 14th century thinking. And from it emerged the two dominant figures of late scholasticism, and these were John Duns Scotus and William of Ockham. And they severed natural science from theology, and they paved the way for what is called nominalism, to which I will return, the basic philosophy of our modern times. It's important, of course, not to treat medieval thinkers as if they are modern scientists, but we also have to realize that they are involved in this change of attitude towards nature from symbolic, allegorical, and subjective to naturalistic and objective. The Middle Ages really contributed hugely to our present civilization, but much of this history has been badly distorted, first by the period we call the Renaissance, and is the 15th century Renaissance in particular. There, the growing influence in classical languages and study denigrated the contribution made by the scholastics and their followers, primarily because medieval Latin was not as elegant as the great traditional Latin of Cicero. These tendencies to ignore the reality of history were strongly encouraged by 18th century rationalist historians such as Voltaire, and even more strongly influenced in the 19th century by Auguste Comte, who is considered the father of sociology, and he made the aims of such men as Galileo and Newton be what he thought them to be rather than what they themselves stated them to be. The idea that Comte somehow knew what was really in the minds of long-dead thinkers has created a very negative effect on history, and this was only started to be corrected following the Second World War and has happened throughout the second half of the 20th century. Now, I'd like to start looking in more detail and less generality. I'm going to start with the greatest fertility in the history of the church, which is the so-called patristic age, and this lasted from the mid-4th to the early 6th century, with such church fathers as Athanasius, Basil, Ambrose, Jerome, and Augustine. These people created a framework for the thinking of the Middle Ages and even, quite strangely enough, for the Reformation. There was a growing emphasis on the importance of the Virgin Mary and the construction of institutions such as monasticism. Despite the end of the Roman Empire, the influence of the church was strongly felt among its rather fragmented successors. But then the huge influence of Islam and the split between the Eastern and Western versions of Christian theology arose, and those, of course, are unhealed even today. Nothing resembling real science occurred to this time, of course, but the developing structure of Western Europe and its theology were established, and this theology was extremely important to the changes we will discuss. The Roman Empire, of course, was created primarily by Caesar Augustus as the rule of one particular individual. And that always has the problem of that, the strength and character of that in that single individual. But the emphasis in Rome on the army and this, the direction of the economy to the support and structure of the army led to the fact that Roman generals who were popular with their troops became important political figures whether or not they were from the traditional Roman nobility. This led to troubles and dissension within the empire, and of course there was the nibbling at the edges by various tribes to the north and to the east, and eventually, in order to quell the situation, four emperors were created, and a tetrarchy created amongst these four people who divided up the empire. There was a serious problem with the Christians at this time in the Roman Empire, because the Christians would not sacrifice to the Roman gods. This might seem a trivia to many of us today, but this was crucial to the Romans because sacrifices at those times represented one's loyalty, sense of loyalty to the emperor, and therefore the citizenship of the Roman Empire. And such refusal to do sacrifices was considered treasonous, and they were treated that way. Of course, for the Christians, sacrificing to anyone but the true God would condemn their souls to perdition forever. And this is an irreconcilable conflict. But from the Roman point of view, this led to tremendous persecutions, particularly for a decade under the Emperor Diocletian, which was considered very severe. But Diocletian abdicated in 305, and his place was taken by Constantine, who killed all of his rivals and established a single empire, and then converted to Christianity. He also, starting in about 325, established the city of Constantinople on the western shores of the Bosphorus, a city which was completed and dedicated in 330, and remained the capital for him and for the Eastern Empire until the fall of Byzantium to the Turks in 1453, a long time indeed. The name Byzantium, by the way, which also has always puzzled me, I finally looked up, and it comes from the mythological figure of Byzas, who was supposed to have founded a city there in the 7th century BCE. Now, I have here a bust of what Constantine presumably looked like. Before Constantine, Christians had met in private homes, and they had a room dedicated to religious functions such as baptism. There was no Christian architecture per se, but the Romans, of course, had very serious architecture, and they had law courts in buildings called basilicas, which were long, narrow structures with roofs held up by columns, and a rounded apse at one end, and in this apse sat the judge or even the emperor to make their judgments of a particular time. And so this was quickly adopted and adopted by the Christians as the basic form for the church. They quickly added a transept across in a perpendicular way to make the building in the shape of a cross. What we don't know about, I mean, there's a lot of history that has vanished into these times because we just don't have any records. And in particular, it's regrettable that we have very few records of what are called the coming of the Huns. The Huns were a nomadic people from Central Asia. And, of course, nomads of those times are considered to be savage and brutal, and they probably were. But what is but nomads in those days had a very set pattern of travel. They would go from summer pastures to wintering grounds and back and forth as the seasons changed. Why they decided to move west is unknown, but they did move, and they pushed the Goths, who were in their way, and the Goths pushed the Romans. And the Romans had been badly weakened by all this internecine warfare. The Goths are vaguely divided into two groups. They're the Ostrogoths, which probably means Eastern Goths, and they lived originally in the Caucasus region, which is a hotbed of trouble right now, and the Visigoths, which likely means Western Goths, and they lived more or less around the Balkan regions. By about 400 in the Common Era, the Visigoths, under their king Alaric, were invading Roman territory. Now, Rome, of course, the empire was based in Constantinople, but it had administrative centers in lots of other places, and it had a western administrative center in Milan, which was not easily defendable, and this center was moved from Milan to Ravenna. Ravenna was much more easily defendable because it existed on very marshy ground, and attacking it was very difficult. And Alaric was unable to conquer Ravenna, but he did make an agreement with the Roman generals there, and then they went back and reneged on that agreement, and that made him angry, and so he unable to take Ravenna, he moved south and sacked Rome in 410. Following his death, his army kind of gave up. They moved back north, they crossed the Alps and disappeared. Even though the Visigoths were pretty brutal, but then so were the Romans, they had been converted to Christianity, but they were adherents of a different version of Christianity called Arianism. Arianism was declared heretical in the Council of Nicaea in 325. But Arius lived in Alexandria, and he held that the Trinitarian idea, the idea in which the Son and the Holy Spirit were equal to the Father, that this was wrong. He used the Platonic ideal of God as eternal and unknowable. Well, Jesus was knowable, and he had been seen on earth and described by the apostles. Jesus came later than God, and therefore he could not be equivalent to God. Well, this was, declared heretical in an effort led by the Bishop Athanasius, who has become Saint Athanasius, so we quickly see who won. Athanasius said that the Father and the Son were like the sight of two eyes. I find it interesting in history that the Arian heresy was alive again in 17th century England, particularly where the strongest adherent of it was that peculiar man Isaac Newton, who, to keep himself out of trouble, was very careful to hide his beliefs. It did not take long after the sack of Rome for clerical authority to reestablish itself there. Rome was the center of Christian belief because Saints Peter and Paul were presumably both killed and buried there. And Christ had said in Matthew's Gospel that Peter is the rock upon which I shall build my church. And Peter, of course, comes from the Latin Petrus, meaning rock. And this gave Rome a claim to precedent, to prominence throughout all the time, particularly under the reign of Pope Leo I, who is known to history as Leo the Great. The most important thing that happened in his reign was not these arguments over the church, but the fact that he met in 452 on the shores of Lake Garda with the Hun chieftain Attila. And this has been immortalized in a painting by Raphael, my favorite artist, in 1514. Catholic historians of the next few centuries gave Leo complete credit for convincing Attila not to attack Italy. But personally, I find it hard to imagine that a pagan Hun chieftain could be convinced by Christian arguments about the fate of his soul. And it's much more likely that the plague, which was always common in large groups of people, and the inability to feed his troops was probably more likely the reason. But the various sacks of Rome, Attila did withdraw, but this didn't stop everything because Vandal armies sacked Rome again just 3 years later in 455, sufficiently brutally that they have given the name of their tribe to the English language for people who do not behave properly. And as I said, the various sacks of Rome were considerably important in the western half, but not particularly in the eastern half, who didn't care of it all that much. What was interesting and important in the eastern half of the empire was the work of St. Augustine, who between 413 and 425 wrote this magisterial work, The City of God. And his aim in this was primarily to divorce Christian theology from the Roman Imperium, to separate, if we will, in modern terms, the church and the state. And because there had been a strong identification of Christianity before his time with the Roman Empire, now settled in centered in Constantinople. In the Eastern Empire, there was a lot of dissension amongst the various important centers, particularly between the ever-increasingly important see of Constantinople and that of Alexandria. Constantinople was represented first by John Chrysostom and then by the next patriarch, Nestorius. Chrysostom has gone on to become a saint in the Eastern Rite, but Nestorius was kicked out because he made some crucial tactical errors. It is hard for us to understand how significant these were, because they generally are over a given word or two. For example, there was a growing popular interest in Mary as a person. And Nestorius said that she could be considered as the mother of the human Jesus, but not as the mother of the divine Jesus in the bearer of God, if you will, which in Greek is Theotokos. There was a continuing conflict between the human and the divine. This we've seen already. I've mentioned this in Arianism, and it was the divide theology for centuries. Nestorius, because of this philosophy, was exiled from Constantinople, but he was very popular amongst the Syriac-speaking peoples who centered in his hometown or home area of Antioch. But the Nestorians were driven out and eventually settled in western Iran or western Persia, where they maintained very significant influence, that influence extending east as far as the borders of China. And more importantly for the future, they maintained the primary repository of the great Greek philosophical writings which had disappeared in the West. Yet another schism in Christian theology arose at this time. It's a monophysite schism, and this is a single nature view of the human and divine Christ as being indistinguishable and inseparable. This was championed first by the Alexandrians, as was the Arian heresy, but then that was reversed, and that too was declared heretical by the Council of Chalcedon in 451. Chalcedon was a village at the time, is now a neighborhood in Istanbul. That council established an orthodox formulation of two natures in one person. But there was a bitter division between the monophysites and the so-called orthodox and its variant meophysitism. And this remains today, this idea, in the Coptic Church, the Syrian Church, the Armenian Church, and the Ethiopian churches. The Council of Chalcedon irritated Pope Leo in Rome because they established dogma, and only he was allowed to establish dogma, and he wrote this massive work called the Tome of Leo, but since it said everything that the council had said, it was accepted. But it represents the first schism, the first crack in what became irreconcilable differences between the Eastern and Western Church, which culminated in 1054 by a split which is still unhealed. The council did not end all controversies, particularly in Syria and Egypt, and there were incredibly violent clashes between various believers, which remained continued until the conquest of that region by the Arab Islamic armies in the 7th century. Amongst the most violent of the participants in these clashes were monks. And the rise of monasticism is really a result of the Eastern influence on Western Christianity. The early church was characterized by what they called the blessed martyrdom of many of its adherents, and considerable attention was paid to prolonging the suffering of these poor people. But the acceptance of Christianity by Constantine ended that persecution, and that meant that various ascetics had to look for their suffering elsewhere. And there became quite conscious competition between the Syrians and the Egyptians for what is called it's been described as athletes vying in exercises for God's glory. They would stand day and night. They would not eat cooked food for years on end, etc. But the rise in monasticism began very early. It began around 250 in Egypt, because Egypt had already had a considerable pre-Christian history of ascetic belief. St. Anthony, about 250, took very seriously the idea from Christ that those people who would be perfect should sell all their worldly goods. Now, monasticism is really an implied criticism of the decision of the church to go from a small, tight group of people to a more widely, large-scale, inclusive organization. When it was a tiny organization with only a few adherents, it was easy to maintain discipline and asceticism and live as Christ had lived. But as the church became larger and bigger and richer, and people have a desire for comfort and worldly goods, this led to problems and people trying to continually, as we shall see, reintroduce this sort of asceticism. So what Anthony did is he moved out into the desert where he practiced both asceticism and self-mortification, like hurting himself. And this led to a reputation for holiness, and therefore people who did not have that same strength of character as Anthony coming to him to look for spiritual guidance. And he didn't like becoming popular, so he moved ever farther out into the desert, which led to more people coming, and, you know, ad infinitum. These people were not communities, but there would be groups of 200 to 300 men, and they were looking for individual salvation by talking to or getting advice from Anthony, and they became known by the Greek word monachos, which we'd call monk. This movement attracted attention in lots of other countries, particularly in Syria, but in Syria the distinction between desert and city is not as sharp as it is in Egypt. And that led to the rather peculiar idea of a vertical separation rather than a horizontal separation. And this led to the appearance of a movement called the Stylites, where monks would establish themselves on top of pillars. And this started, it's named after Saint Simon Stylites, who died about 460. He lived on top of a pillar, which was is said to be about 20 meters high, with the top about 1 meter in diameter, sitting in a wicker basket, not unlike, I think, the baskets that we see on modern hot air balloons, and he had a manacle around his neck to keep him from falling off when he was asleep. Supplies were occasionally brought up to him by disciples, either by ladder or by basket on ropes that he could bring up. After his death, his place was taken by a disciple named Daniel, who spent 33 years sitting in that basket. And it was said, horribly, that when he died, his legs had putrefied by never being used for 33 years. Now, what is amazing, again, to our modern perspective, is these men exerted considerable secular influence because they were considered holy. More amusingly, as due to all these various schisms that arose, it apparently was not uncommon to have saints yelling theological abuse at one another from the tops of their pillars. Athanasius, who was often in trouble with the authorities, was exiled from Egypt and brought back to Egypt time and again. But he brought the idea of monasticism to Rome. And there the tradition took on a different flavor. It became much more urban than rural. And the priority was given to community rather than to self-mortification and solitude. But both in the East and in the West, this growing monastic influence made these people independent of ecclesiastical authority, and that made them difficult to control. Monks were very violent, and they would go around murdering bishops with whom they disagreed. In particular, for the history of mathematics and astronomy, they killed that brilliant female philosopher, Neoplatonic philosopher Hypatia, and they sacked lots of temples. But that in particular was a gruesome thing to do. The penetration of these Germanic tribes, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, the Franks, the Burgundians, the Vandals, into the Roman Empire, caused the loss of a lot of knowledge that had previously existed. But these growing monasteries became the repositories of what knowledge remained. In particular, after the foundation of the first great monastery at Monte Cassino near Naples in 529 by Saint Benedict, these were in particularly important in the revival of knowledge in Ireland in the 6th and 7th centuries, in Northumbria in the 7th century at the time of the Venerable Bede, and established very strongly by Charlemagne in the 9th century. Greek philosophy posed such questions, and these were in these monasteries, as to the nature of time, space, and matter. For example, is time real? Does time depend upon consciousness? Is change necessary for time to exist? Has the universe always existed, as Aristotle will say, or was there a beginning, as the Bible says? Can we escape from time? Can God escape from time? How can God create the world and still intervene in it? Does time flow or does it stand still? All kinds of questions about this, about space, about matter, etc. What knowledge did remain was, of course, heavily influenced by Plato and the growth of Neoplatonism in the early Christian era. The principal channel of this was in St. Augustine, who had read Plato and had read Plotinus and was searching for the essences, for the ideals that Plato wrote about. And interestingly enough, he found these ideals in mathematics, in particular in arithmetic. And he says as follows, the things that we see from our senses are changeable and can be born and die, but by gosh, 7 and 3 are 10, and they always will be 10, and they're 10 for everybody forever, and this is common knowledge. And that's the kind of things that Plato was interested in. Now, the end of the Western Roman Empire was accompanied by an invasion of northern Italy by these Ostrogoths in 488, and that was under King Theodoric, whose tomb we saw at the beginning. He besieged Ravenna for a long time, and despite the marshy ground, finally managed to conquer it, and he entered the city under an agreement with the Roman generals in 493, and they had made this peace pact. He immediately killed the Roman generals and took complete control. These were rough times. So is our time, but that's all right. Theodoric, however, despite killing his rivals, was not an untutored barbarian. He had been a captive in Constantinople for at least a decade, and he was well-versed in Greek philosophy. He maintained much of the Roman governing structure, and in particular the Senate. One of his senators was a man by the name of Boethius. Boethius was a highly educated Roman and was a Catholic, while Theodoric was an Arian. And that was not the source of the trouble. The source of the trouble was the conflict between Theodoric and the Byzantines in Constantinople. And Boethius was accused of conspiring with these with the empire, the Imperium in the East, and he was tried. It's probably a false accusation, but he was tried and sentenced to death. While he was in prison, he had written a lot of things and was fluent in Greek and had translated some of the works from Greek to Latin. But while he was in prison, he wrote a very famous book called The Consolations of Philosophy. This is a dialogue between himself and a female figure representing philosophy. It's a deeply religious book. It invokes a higher benign power that is rather similar to the Platonic ideal and the secular world being of rather secondary importance. He was executed in a particularly dreadful manner, which I will skip. But his book was widely distributed for at least the next 1,000 years, and it's mentioned in Dante's Divine Comedy and exerted considerable influence. But this entire time that we're talking about was marked by numerous schisms and divisions within the Christian faith. There were various ecumenical councils that considered dogmas that were arising from Rome, from Antioch, from Alexandria, from Constantinople, and just to name a few to give you a flavor of how what an uproar there was in religion in those days. There was Arianism, which I talked about, monophysitism. There was the Nestorianism, there was the Acacian schism, there was Miaphysitism, there was Donatism, Novatianism, Melissianism, Manichaeism, Pelagianism, Monophylite, and regular ordinary Catholicism. And these were almost entirely about the nature of Christ. These dogmas, which were very viciously fought and competed over, were also confused between military and political alliances. For example, the fact that Theodoric was such a violent opponent of the empire led to the Byzantines making alliances with the Merovingian king Clovis, who controlled Gaul. Now, the last thing, and I'm trying desperately to finish within the time. Unrest in the East led to riots in Constantinople between rival groups called the Blues and the Greens by about 530, when the Emperor Justinian, here he is in Mosaic, was ruling. Now, because there was a lot of trouble at home, he decided to start a war. People still do that in order to deflect criticism from local things. And being a Catholic, he decided to invade the Arian-controlled areas of North Africa, which were under the control of the Vandals. His army under General Belisarius landed in the Bay of Tunis in 533 and quickly conquered most of it, including the capital of the Vandals at Carthage. And following this, he invaded Italy and struggled against the Lombard tribes, and that was a very slow and 20 years of struggle without much success. The imperial forces had a governorship in Ravenna and in Rome, but were largely gone. We can see some of these changes by looking at maps, first about 500, and here you can see the Byzantine Empire, Slavs, Ostrogoths, Visigoths having all of Spain, the Franks, etc., Saxons, Angles, Celts, Danes, etc. And then if we go 150 years later, 650, in particular, these are Avars, which were pagan tribes at the time. Here's the empire. And here's the empire. Here we see the Byzantines, but this is the growing Arab-Islamic influence which was already significant by 650, as we can see. The Western world was in considerable trouble in the 6th and 7th centuries. The Eastern Empire was fighting a series of lackluster struggles with the Persians, and both of these empires were under threat from people who were from tribes to the north and the east of them. The in the early 7th century, the pendulum swung and the Persians made rapid progress throughout Anatolia, and they came right to the borders. They came up to the Bosphorus here, and the Byzantines were also being attacked by the peoples of this Slavic world here, and so they were under great threat. But surprisingly, they managed to survive, and this was attributed to a miraculous intervention by the Virgin Mary. All kinds of religious upheavals were taking place at this time. And there were various Jewish kingdoms established in the peninsula of Arabia, and in particular, the Yemeni king was converted to Judaism. The rise of Ethiopian philosophers occurred during the 6th century in this time. But all of this conflict really serves merely as a background to what was surely the most dramatic and far-ranging events to affect the Middle East, the Near East, the entire Mediterranean basin, and much of Europe between the breakup of the Roman Empire in the 5th century and the discovery of the New World some 1,000 years later. This, of course, was the emergence of Islam and the creation of an Arab empire, something I shall discuss tomorrow. Thank you very much.